Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
I think clearly it does indicate that Israel is taking notice of the actions that Australia's taking.
Israel has been quick to respond to Australia's cancellation of the visa of a far-right member of Israel's parliament who was due to visit Australia this week. Israel reacted by revoking the visas of Australian representatives to the Palestinian Authority. Also coming up on The Wire...
And you don't even have to open a book to read. You know, audiobooks are great, illustrations are great, graphic novels are great. It's about telling kids that reading is not, you know, something with big, boring, dusty books. It's about finding a place to connect with other people.
It's time to book your adventure. Award-winning author and illustrator Jess McGeckin invites us into his whimsical world as the nation celebrates Children's Book Week. It's the 80th anniversary, so stay tuned for this story and more coming up on The Wire. But first, today Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers have called upon some of the biggest names in Australian economics to suggest how they might adapt Australia's economy to be ready for the future. The main goal of the round table is to boost productivity in Australia, which has dropped from 1.8% to 0.9% in the past two decades. There will also be discussion on how to reform several government schemes, such as the NDIS, the building laws, and also working benefits such as the proposal of the four-day work week. James Bale asked independent economist Saul Eslake what were some of the factors that have led to this decline in productivity and what can be done to address those factors.
Relatively low levels of business investment, especially outside of the mining sector, since the onset of the global financial crisis now 17 years ago, which have meant that workers have less capital, less tools and equipment to work with, and relatively low wages have encouraged employers to substitute labour for capital. Secondly, there's clearly been a decline in labour mobility. That is, workers moving from jobs to which they're perhaps not as well suited to ones for which they're better suited, and particularly for younger workers, ones which are better paid. I would argue that in Australia, government policies that have tended to favour small business have had an adverse impact on productivity growth, because productivity in small businesses is about 19% below the average for all businesses, and small business accounts for a declining share of total employment. And then finally, there hasn't really been any significant productivity-enhancing reforms. Productivity-enhancing reform has become more politically challenging, and instead what we've had is a proliferation of regulation which have had a dampening impact on productivity growth and an adverse impact on business costs.
Another one of these major productivity reforms is the four-day working week. Will this be beneficial or counterintuitive for boosting productivity?
At face value, an across-the-board mandate of a four-day working week with no change in pay would represent an increase in costs to employers of at least 20%. And that's something that would almost certainly result in some combination of higher inflation and reduced employment or increased unemployment. And I certainly have no objection to workers and their unions and employers seeking to negotiate trade-offs like that. But to have it mandated and enforced through law would, I think, have an adverse impact on productivity rather than a positive one.
One of the key talking points for the roundtable is the changes to the NDIS. What are some of the ways that the government can reform the NDIS to make it more financially sustainable?
I think the issues with the NDIS are the implications of the continued very rapid growth in the cost to the federal government in particular of this scheme. The target of 8% per annum still implies that it will continue to grow as a share of the economy. There's obviously evidence that state governments have been shifting the cost of some of the programs they've traditionally administered to the NDIS in order to do that. It may well be that the government needs to find other ways of constraining the rate of growth in spending on that scheme. Or alternatively, if they can't do that, then the conversation perhaps needs to shift to what other ways can be found of paying for that scheme so that it's not funded by borrowed money. There were, at the beginning of this process, some fairly high ambitions that the roundtable could launch a more comprehensive round of tax reform, but the Prime Minister has been quick to hose down any of that talk. Hopefully, the roundtable might clear the way for the government to have an adult conversation with the electorate that might allow the government to seek a mandate for more ambitious tax reforms after the 2028 election. It would seem that that's the best that we can hope for, given the parameters that the Prime Minister has laid down.
Should be taken into account when it comes to preparing the country for the current financial uncertainty?
Governments need to make it clear that there are limits to what they can do to cope with external shocks. In particular, the economic policies being imposed by the Trump administration are likely to result in certainly higher inflation and lower economic growth in the United States. What the US is doing results in weaker economic growth in China. That will have some adverse consequences for the Australian economy, given that China takes more than 36% of Australia's exports. They've avoided unnecessarily antagonizing the United States without unnecessarily giving anything away. But in other respects, I think the roundtable may result in some short-term measures that would be helpful in dealing with specific challenges. For example, reducing the regulatory burden that is imposed on dwelling construction and speeding up the process of approving new housing construction, which, as the productivity chair pointed out this week, has blown out by 50% over the last couple of decades. But in addition to that, my hope is that the roundtable will mark the beginning of what would need to be extended and careful conversations with the Australian electorate to persuade them of the need for more comprehensive reforms, with a view not just to improving productivity, but for sharing the benefits of faster productivity growth equitably between employers, workers and consumers, but also for repairing the nation's finances and putting the finances of the federal government and most of the states and territory governments into better shape and more sustainable shape over the longer term.
Independent economist Saul Eslake there, speaking with James Bale on the Economic Reform Roundtable. You're listening to The Wire, broadcasting all around Australia. And a big hello if you're listening to Edge Radio in Hobart, in 3BB Ballarat, where you can find Radio Gold, or in 8CC in the heart of the nation, Alice Springs. I'm Roderick Chambers. Australia has cancelled a visa of a member of Israel's religious Zionist party, Simcha Rothman, who is due to commence a tour of Australia this week. Sanctions on Israel are one of the key demands of the Palestinian activists, who will again be marching in cities around Australia this Sunday, and is seen as a way of applying pressure to Israel to end the war in Gaza. To date, the Albanese government had only issued sanctions against two of the most controversial members of Israel's government, and this move to cancel Simcha Rothman's visa could be seen as an increase in pressure. Liz Cush asked Professor of International Law at the Australian National University, Don Rothwell, how he reads Israel's reaction to revoke the visas of Australia's representatives to the Palestinian Authority.
It certainly is indicative of the fact that Israel is now trying to take its own retaliatory actions against Australia in response to the Australian decision to announce that it's going to recognise a Palestinian state. But it's also been linked to the withdrawal of a visa by the Australian government to the proposed visit of an Israeli politician. But I think clearly it does indicate that Israel is taking notice of the actions that Australia is taking, and of course the statements that have been made by Australia's political leaders.
I'd like to speak to you about the article that you published in The Guardian recently. You wrote that the time has come for the Albanese government to do more than just issue statements decrying breaches of international law against Israel. What further actions do you think that Australia can take to sanction Israel?
Under Australian law, the Australian government can decide to sanction various individuals for human rights violations or for egregious breaches of international law as determined by the Australian government. So that is an option that they can clearly seek to pursue, and they haven't sought to do so yet directly in relation to the events with respect to Israel's military and political conduct in Gaza.
Do you think that Australia taking more actions to increase the number of sanctions against Israeli ministers or Israeli members of parliament would be an effective measure? Will it have an impact on Israel, as well as other actions Australia can take, such as ending the 2E arms trade? Will these things actually be effective or make any difference in putting pressure on Israel to withdraw troops from Gaza?
Travel bans would have a limited impact. Financial sanctions on Israeli politicians, for example, but also likewise have a limited impact. Nevertheless, I think that they send out a significant message in terms of Australia's displeasure with this conduct, and indicates that whilst Australia has been a strong and reliable supporter of Israel for many, many decades, Australia's view at the moment is that Israel's conduct and the conduct of whoever might be subject to these sanctions are ones that Australia doesn't find acceptable. Therefore, various consequences will follow. On the separate question with respect to the export of various Australian products which might contribute to the Israeli military effort in Gaza, that also raises a series of issues which ultimately would directly impact upon Australia's contribution to the Israeli military effort by way of Australian exporters. It's well within the reach of the Albanese government to place very significant constraints on exports of any type which might be going to Israel, which might be finding their way into the Israeli military campaign. And that extends all the way from matters that have been recently the subject of debate and discussion, such as parts that are contributing to the F-35 fighters that Israel operates, but also to simple things like food that might find its way into the military supply chain in Israel. So basically what I'm saying is that it's well within the remit of the Australian government to reconsider all Australian exports from Australia to Israel, given the very serious allegations being made against Israel with respect to violations of international humanitarian law, and of course mindful that Israel is currently defending itself in the International Court of Justice on charges of genocide.
Professor Don Rothwell from the Australian National University speaking there with Liz Cush.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
It's the 80th anniversary of Children's Book Week. Created by the Children's Book Council of Australia, the annual event is celebrated in Australian schools, running this year from the 16th to the 23rd of August. Book Week aims to inspire young minds and to embrace the joy of reading through costume parades, storytelling sessions, and library displays, with this year's theme being Book and Adventure. Jess McGeckin is this year's featured artist, an award-winning illustrator and author who spoke to Ruby Ward about what inspires his work and how we can think about books being more than just words.
Yes, I did create a big, beautiful map for Book Week this year. I think the inspiration came from a whole lot of places. But when I think about adventure and I think about reading, I think about my favourite books having maps in the end papers. So it's often when you read like a big fantasy novel or even a picture book and you open the cover and there's a map on the inside, it kind of tells me that there's already an adventure waiting to happen or a whole new world to discover. So that was kind of my inspiration, with those kind of end papers from books like Treasure Island and all those fantasy books. And so I knew I wanted to create a map, and then the characters kind of came from all parts of my life. So there's a giant squid because I love underwater creatures and I work at a museum, and there's a puffin who loves treasure and a dragon who isn't a very good cook but still loves to try anyway. So yeah, that's the inspiration behind those.
Oh, that's so gorgeous. And I'm sure it's something that kids really love. Children's imaginations are just so wild. But according to the Reading Guarantee report released in February 2024, a third of Australian children can't read properly, or in the typical Aussie classroom, out of 24 students, 8 can't read as well. In your opinion, how can we foster engagement to reading kids when maybe at home they mightn't be encouraged to, and we're living in this sort of digital age now?
It's such a good question. And as someone that has recently had a new baby, I'm thinking about him a lot and how much, you know, what we can do to read to him, and especially as he gets a bit older. I think one of the best things we can do is thinking about books as more than just words. And I guess, you know, I've been in a lot of libraries this week for Book Week. And, you know, when I was little, the library was always the safe space because I didn't love sport and I didn't love, you know, I don't know, always being outside. So I really loved coming into the library. And I think if we can kind of treat reading as if it's a safe thing to do, and you don't even have to open a book to read, you know, audiobooks are great, illustrations are great, graphic novels are great. So I think it's about telling kids that reading is not, you know, something with big, boring, dusty books, although that can be great too. It's about finding a place to connect with other people. But yeah, we've got our work cut out for us very much so in the next couple of years, but hopefully that will help.
Oh, congrats. That's amazing news. That's great.
Yeah, thank you very much. A different responsibility.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice because kids are so visual. And it is an adventure. And when I think of Book Week, I'm filled with memories of homemade costumes, last minute scrambles with glue guns and feather boas.
For sure.
Yeah. What are some of your fondest Book Week memories as a child, or your most memorable character you might have dressed up as?
Oh my gosh, what a good question. I have very fond memories of some last minute costumes as well. I remember looking for the right stick at the park for a wand when I was going to be a wizard. The last-minute costumes were always the best ones. I can remember, I used to love, and I still do, I love Graham Bass's books, so Animalia and The 11th Hour, and those books are filled with lots of hidden details, so I always used to love costumes that kind of were an ode to that time. So just definitely dressing up as some of the characters and animals from those books. But I just remember it was, like I said before, I wasn't very sporty, but I remember the one week of the year where we could kind of celebrate art and books, and that meant a lot to me growing up.
Award-winning author and illustrator Jess McGeckin speaking there with Ruby Ward.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
A recent report has revealed that cricket played at all levels around the world is at risk due to the extreme conditions in which matches are being played. The report outlines the rising temperatures that are causing great strain on players' bodies, as well as the declining air quality in some parts of the world, and that is also affecting players' respiratory systems. In light of this, it was revealed that Australia recorded a 5-year average of 46 days when the temperature was over 37 degrees. James Bale asked Dr. Paul Govind, lecturer at the Centre of Environmental Law at Macquarie University, what are the effects of prolonged exposure to extreme conditions and what sport governing bodies can do to preserve the game?
The issue really how often these temperatures are going to be breached. One thing we have to be aware of when we talk about temperature is that it will be different for different people. Now, why is that important for sport? Well, because you have different age groups playing sport. And so adults will have a higher tolerance for heat than children. I think what the important thing is, it's becoming less tolerable for all people, and that the adequate adaptation measures are taken.
Last year, Australia recorded 46 days of temperatures gone above 37. So how's that number changed in the past 15, 20 years?
There's a clear rise there. We see this sort of pattern where we have more hot days. The hot days are going to be distributed in particular times in the calendar.
So what are some of the long-term effects of prolonged exposure to extreme temperatures?
We will see higher levels of dehydration. We will see higher levels of physical, but also sort of psychological and mental impacts as well. The long-term effects, it could be physical health, it could be mental health. That will have to look at the way we adapt to these things and perhaps change these practices.
In addition, earlier this year, several matches in the India Premier League were played in air quality that was deemed unhealthy. So is there any like variations in the symptoms when it comes to air pollution compared to just extreme temperatures in general?
Countries such as India have had problems with the quality of their air, you know, breathable air, for some time. It's the consequence, say, of things like, well, it could be traffic, it could just be other sorts of industry. Now you have intersection between two really dangerous outcomes. You have the heat and you have the low air quality. Now, in my opinion, that is impossible to play in those circumstances. It doesn't really matter who you are. You could just be playing kids-level stuff or you could be a professional like in the IPL.
With cricket being a predominantly daytime summer sport, do you believe a change of date and time that matches are played is necessary at all levels of the game?
Yeah, I think this is something that seriously has to be contemplated. And again, you know, we're moving, say, we move from the professional level down, you know, Saturday morning junior stuff. I think it has to really be on the table. I think that with the professional game, there is the benefit of stadiums that are equipped with adequate lighting. We are putting not just players, but when we talk about the professional game with cricket, we're probably putting fans at risk as well. And I think this is another issue here. Now, moving further down into sort of more local sport, how do we get around this? Well, that's a bit more tricky because we can't play the matches in the evening. Do we start the matches earlier? Probably. That would have to be one of the things we do. And that would probably mean that some sport, some age groups cannot really be on the weekend. Maybe they have to be shifted to the week somehow. I'm not sure how to do that, to be honest, but I think these are some of the measures that we'll have to take.
Several governing bodies of cricket around the world are joining together to implement new heat policies to protect the game. What do you believe these policies should include?
Well, I think the policy should include the potential for rescheduling. I think the policy should include more frequent and longer drinks breaks. I think we need to also look carefully at the surface. Now, most international cricket would simply be played on natural grass. I think we need to be very careful as well, though, if there is any synthetic materials used at any time. It simply does not absorb water as well. There's no natural cooling effect to the ground. I think we also need to consider things like perhaps a better form of monitoring of players' health and players' performance. And I think what's important as well is when that data is being gathered, I think the ways in which fluctuations in temperature, changes in temperature, how that has been affecting performance and health of athletes needs to be taken into account. Like anything, climate change is going to affect the fundamentals of how a game works.
Dr. Paul Govin from the Centre of Environmental Law at Macquarie University there speaking with James Bale. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.